Holy men, take your Bibles this evening and turn to the book of Revelation with me, to a passage that I would never have picked if I wasn't going through the book of Revelation. Chapter 13. Revelation chapter 13. Several people have asked me, hey, I've been really enjoying your series through the book, and I've said before, I didn't actually ever intend to do a series. I just did one, and then I did the next spot, and then I did the next spot, and now it just seems like kind of a waste to just haphazardly stop in the middle. But as I've walked through, we've seen a lot of principles that I was surprised to find that are actually pertinent to our everyday life. But Revelation chapter 13 is not usually one where we try to find everyday principles to our life. Yet, there are some that are definitely there. And there are some that he tells us to find. So I want to look at that this evening. Before we do that, I want to remind you of a very quick story that you all might know. When Jesus was on this earth during his ministry, before his ministry really began, he went out into the wilderness, and after he had fasted for 40 days, Satan came to him and he tempted him with several very specific temptations. But one of them, which we remember, was he took him to the top of a mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of men. And he told him that he would give him all the kingdoms of men, everything that he could see, if he were to first bow down and to worship him. That's in Matthew chapter 4. Of course, Jesus responded that we are only supposed to worship the Lord thy God and him only. But what we see in Revelation chapter 13 is another instance where apparently Satan has offered another person this very thing. And rather than making the decision that Jesus did, he chose to take the offer. The book of Revelation is primarily about Jesus winning. But it's very messy in the process. Because in Revelation chapter 5, when he takes the book that's in the right hand of the Father, the one who sits on the throne, which is the lost inheritance of man, and he begins to break the seals in order to reclaim the world and give it back to us, the process involves judgment, punishment, and ridding all of those who seek to oppose him. So judgments are poured out on the world with seals and trumpets. But very soon, partway through the book, we see that Jesus is going to return. He says, in the days when the seventh trumpet is blown, he will return, and the kingdoms of this world will become the kingdoms of Christ. But as we saw last time we were here, which was some 2 months ago, the book of Revelation pauses, Revelation chapter 11, and it goes back across the story from a different perspective. Rather than seeing the story from the perspective of Christ and the perspective of God, it sees the story from the perspective of the enemy and the perspective of Satan. And in Revelation chapter 12, what we see is the great dragon who is the opposer of God, who fights with God. But though John in that chapter saw Satan for who he was in his red suit and horns, completely undisguised, that's not, of course, how Satan works in this world, is it? He works through people and through systems. And so after we see Satan and him coming to this world to persecute God's people, whether Israel or the church, we see in Revelation chapter 13 how exactly he intended to do that. And so we get a very interesting picture here as we open this chapter. So I want us to look at it. I want to walk through the chapter as quickly as I can to see the picture of what's going on, because if I try to apply it as we go along, you might wonder where we're getting all this. So I want to go through it as quickly as we can, and then I want to pull some application from it. So look at verse number 1 and 2. This one's going to be a little bit of work, okay? So you got to stick with me, and I'm going to try to make it as painless as possible, okay? Verse number 1 and 2, he says this, "And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his heads the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority." So several things to note. First of all, John has changed his perspective completely. John has been seeing this entire book from the perspective of heaven. And he gets to see what's happening on this earth, and then he gets to look at the throne and see how God thinks of this, and how the elders think of this, and how the beasts think about this. But now the perspective is down on the shore, and he's looking out across the sea. And a beast rises out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. Now, if I had just preached last week, you probably would have caught the correlation. But the last thing that we've seen having 7 heads and 10 horns is the red dragon from chapter 12. See, this beast is connected automatically to Satan. And it even tells us that the dragon gave him his seat and his authority and his power. And it says that he has crowns and power and authority. So whatever this beast is, he has authority on this earth, and it's given to him by Satan. The sea is usually a picture of the people. And he's come from the people, but he has the power from the opposer of God. But why a beast? Like, why not just say it's a person? Because the book wants you to think about something. Remember, the book is the last book in the Bible, and so it expects you to know the whole Bible before you open the book of Revelation. And last time we saw a beast with 10 horns was all the way back in the book of Daniel. So pause Revelation for a second. And Daniel sees, Daniel chapter 7, Daniel standing by the shore. And he looks out into the sea. And out of the sea come 4 beasts. One is a lion with wings, one is a bear, one is a leopard, and one is a terrible beast that has 10 horns. And these, he tells us, are the kingdoms of men. The lion, Babylon. The bear, Persia. The leopard, Greece. The terrible beast, Rome. But eventually, there'd be a little horn that speaks great swelling words, and that would be the last kingdom of men. And when we open up Revelation chapter 13, we see a beast coming out of the sea that is a lion, a bear, and a leopard. Did we notice that? You probably were, where is all this coming from? It wants you to think of that. This is all the kingdoms of men together with the horns, the power, the seat, and authority. So he is taking over all of the authority and influence on this world. This is the final future kingdom of mankind over all of the kingdoms of mankind at the same time. Now, having done that, look at verse number 3. I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death. His deadly wound was healed. All the world wondered after the beast. They worshiped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? So allegiance will flock to whoever this is, both the system that he represents and the person who leads it. It will flock to him in spite of, or perhaps because of, his immense opposition that he will have to God himself. Look at verse number 5. There was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. Power was given unto him to continue 42 months, which is 3.5 years. He opened his mouth to blaspheme against God and to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, to overcome them. And power was given unto him over all kindred and tongues and nations, and all them that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of this world. We've seen before, as we walk through the book of Revelation, that phrase, those that dwell upon the earth, represents not those who are followers of Christ, but those who are followers of this world, those who have made this world their home. And when this final world ruler will come, everyone will welcome him with open arms. It's possible that everything that's happening at this time causes people to look for a leader that they can trust, who sounds good, who seems trustworthy, who seems reliable, who says things that makes them feel better, feel safe. And in spite of the fact that he will blaspheme the name of God and all that is good, all of them will worship him. But for every Ahab, there is a Jezebel. For every Pharaoh, there is a Jannes and Jambres. For every Balak, there is a Balaam. And for every Antichrist, there is a false prophet. Because there's always something pointing to him. And so this is where the passage goes. You have the Antichrist, you have this last world ruler, but then you have his false prophet pointing to him. So look at the next passage. Verse number 11. I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and spake as a dragon. He exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he, this second beast, doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell in the earth by means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell in the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live. So the false prophet will speak with great words to draw people to worship this false Christ. He will do miracles. He will do wonders and convince people that they are legitimate. He will set up an image and demand that people worship him. The Bible actually speaks about this last world ruler and this last false Christ. And it speaks about a desecrating thing that he will do halfway through the week. Daniel chapter 9 talks about this and calls it the abomination of desolation. Jesus speaks of this in Matthew chapter 24 and says that when you see this, flee to the mountains. In 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, it says that this wicked, and he capitalizes it, this wicked, when he will be revealed, he will sit on in the temple of God and say that he is God. So all of these things together we're seeing here in this moment where everyone is pointed to him and he commands the people to worship him. And so now that the false prophet has established firmly that the world ruler is to be followed without question, he demands worship from everybody as law. Verse 15. He had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as should not worship the image of the beast should be killed. I'm going to return to some of these things as we go along, but let's finish up. Verse 16. He causeth all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, that no man might buy or sell, save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. The false prophet will require allegiance, or they will be killed, or at least be unable to live and to buy and to sell. And then it tells us this, verse 18, here is wisdom. Let him that hath understanding count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, and his number is 666. So, according to verse 18, somehow, the people at that time will have the understanding, if they are wise, to know what the mark truly is and what his name is and what the number of his name is. Now, what is the mark of the beast? I'm not going to be that nice to you. For some of you who are wondering if I was going to make a claim on that. That's not the point of this passage. Man, I thought it was. No, it's not. It's not. There's actually very few things that have been the impetus to such wild speculation as what the mark of the beast is and what 666 means. In fact, it's almost humorous how ridiculous it becomes. It says, it connects the number to his name, and so some people try to do some very interesting math and equations to somehow make people they don't like into adding their number up together to be 666. 666 has been Nero during the time of the early church. 666 has been Hitler. 666 has also been Obama, I'm pretty sure I saw a YouTube video once. So whoever we don't like becomes the Antichrist. I've seen cartoons pause in the middle of a very important montage of a song that they're having in the bottom of the sea, and they pause it, and they find a bunch of swirly bits, and they highlight them, and there's a whole bunch of really wonky things that now look like a six because we highlighted them, and now this movie is the sign of the Antichrist. I had a teenager come to me one time and very concerned asked me if it was okay to drink a Monster. And I said, you know, a Monster, like a Monster, an energy drink, yeah. And I said, I mean, it's really bad for you? I don't know what the question is. And he said, no, I saw somewhere that the scratch is like a Hebrew letter, like the letter Vav, and that's actually the number six in Hebrew, so that it's three of them together. So is Monster the mark of the beast? And he says, no, I told him, no, I really doubt that the way the Antichrist is going to infiltrate the world is by deceiving them into drinking energy drinks. Okay? Because while that letter is also a six, it is also the letter W in the Hebrew language, which stands for WWW. The internet! You know, we got to stop. We got to stop. We got to stop. That's not the point. This is the point. This is the point. His instruction to these people was that they would be understanding enough to identify who Antichrist was, to see through the lies of the system around them in order to make their decision correctly about whose allegiance I will, who I will give my allegiance to. Because remember, this book wasn't written primarily to the people who will live then. It was written to the seven churches of Asia Minor, who were very scared at that time about the world rulers who were there. In fact, they had some of their own myths about Nero, that he was going to rise again and take over. And they're very concerned about the world system around them, and for good reason. And he's admonishing them to make it stand in their time of pressure and time of oppression, where the world around them says, hey, this is how we do things. And they were being pressured to follow the world system. They had to make a decision to follow Christ instead of the world. When Satan came to Jesus and said, bow down to me and I will give you everything, Jesus said, you only worship the Lord. When Satan came to this Antichrist, he said, bow down to me and I will give you everything. He worshiped Satan. This passage is, he's saying to them, I want you to have wisdom to identify when it is that somebody who's enticing you to follow them is actually anti-me instead of for me. These seven churches, he's saying, you have to make that decision in your life. But these seven churches of Asia Minor, though the book was written to them, this book of Revelation is also written for us. Because let's just assume for the moment that we won't have to deal with any of this. Does that mean there's nothing pertinent in here at all? There's a passage I did not read as we walked through. You might have noticed. I'm going to mention it at the very end. But the Bible actually tells us that though those things are going to happen later, there's a semblance of that happening now. I want you to see one of them. So really quickly, why don't you turn to 1 John chapter 2. Keep your space there. We're going to go through Revelation 13. I'm going to try to go through it as fast as I can. But I want us to see two different passages. I'm going to read one for you. Matthew chapter 24 is Jesus' account of some of the things that would happen in the future. And one of the things that he mentions is this false Christ who will come and who will break covenants and who will persecute God's people. But in the middle of that sermon, Jesus says, Matthew 24:24, you're in 1 John 2. We'll be there in a second. He says this, there shall arise false Christs and false prophets and shall show great signs and wonders insomuch that if it were possible, they should deceive the very elect. He's saying, yeah, there's going to be a false Christ and there's going to be a false prophet, but there are false Christs and there all are false prophets. He says in 1 John chapter 2, verse number 18, this is where you're at. Verse number 18, little children, it's the last time. And as you have heard that Antichrist shall come, even now are there many Antichrists, whereby we know that it is the last time. This is John saying this in the first century. Is it less true today that there are things opposed to Jesus Christ? Verse 19, they went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would no doubt have continued with us. But they went out that they might be manifest that they were not all of us. Verse 20, but ye have an unction from the Holy One, and ye know all things. What is he saying? I want you to have wisdom to identify what's in the world system that you live in that is anti-Christ. Because yes, that's coming. But it's in your world today. And you make a decision today about whether or not you're going to give in to the system given to the draw to pull us away from Jesus for the sake of something else. And so very briefly, I want us to look at this passage. Before I do that, I'm going to give you one quote. J.A. Sice says this: "If we can only have understanding to detect his spirit, which already works so powerfully in so many specious forms about us, we shall have accomplished the most needful reckoning of the number of his name. Without this, we may be carrying his damning mark upon our souls, even whilst we think ourselves forearmed against his power. The moral insight into his nature is the wisdom we require, rather than the orthography of the name by which he is called. In this, therefore, let us try to skill our souls, cleaving ever to our only Lord God and his Son, Jesus Christ, our Savior, in the meekness of a confiding faith and obedience, that no marks or stains of the beast or his abominations, even in spirit, may ever be found upon our souls." The wisdom that we need is not to be able to see whether the mark of the beast is on a monster can. The wisdom that we need is to discover whether or not the Antichrist is in my life, whether I have marked myself with the world by being deceived by the world. And so I'm going to ask two very important questions about tonight. Number one, I'm going to ask, what is Antichrist? I'm going to see from Revelation chapter 13. If that's not going to be my decision personally in its real and literal sense. Now, by the way, if I apply this to our lives, I'm not de-literalizing it in the future. I believe that this will be what it will be in the future. But it doesn't mean that it's not applicable to us today. Right. So I'm going to ask, what is Antichrist? And then I'm going to ask, then why are we deceived by it? Why are we deceived by it? Number one, what is Antichrist? Antichrist, first and foremost, is a denier of Jesus. Antichrist is a denier of Jesus. So go back to Revelation chapter 13. We're out of 1 John 2. We won't return there again, but I wanted you to see how this message is applicable to you today, because the same writer of Revelation told you it was. Okay? Revelation chapter 13, verse number 5, it says this: "There was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies. Power was given unto him to continue 42 months. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven." The word blaspheme means to reproach or even to just speak ill about. Specifically, he's referring to giving bad doctrine or giving a false impression of who Jesus and his people are. That's what it says about Antichrist in 1 John 2. He says, "I have not written unto you because you know not the truth, but because you know it, and that no lie is of the truth." He says, "Who is a liar but he that denieth that Jesus is the Christ?" He is Antichrist that denieth the Father and the Son. See, we live in a world of Jesus deniers. Deny that Jesus even existed, which is kind of going out of style now because it's becoming more and more absurd. People try to deny that Jesus was God, of course. Or that the Bible isn't accurate. It's not reliable to give us a picture of who Jesus is. People try to take his name away and to downplay who Jesus is. But in a smaller sense, that can infiltrate into our lives as well. We can see Peter, who when he was pressured by the world around him and they asked him, "Are you with Jesus?" he denied him 3 times. So while the world is denying him outwardly and openly, sometimes the world can convince us to deny him in our hearts as well, or at least in our name. And to rather have God's mark on us, we'd rather have the world's mark so that we fit into all those around us. So he says, forget Jesus, accept us. Maybe you're struggling with a doctrinal issue about who Christ is. Just know that denials of Jesus' personhood and deity is rooted in Satan himself. But maybe you're trying to just avoid association with Jesus because of the pressure of those around you. Remember that Satan desires to have you just like he desired to have Peter, that he may sift you as wheat. So let me leave that one alone. Antichrist is a denier of Jesus. Secondly, Antichrist is a replacer of Jesus. Antichrist is a replacer of Jesus. So what does he do? When he comes to set up his world system, he doesn't just lead, he requires to be worshipped and have devotion to him. So let everybody look back down. Verse number 4. "They worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast, And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast, who is able to make war with him? Verse 14. The false prophet deceiveth them that dwell in the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell in the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had a wound by sword and did live. He had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. And this is just what we saw in 2 Thessalonians when he sits in the temple and calls himself God. This all focuses back to his kingdom and his personality. And simply telling us this, any ultimate trust and preeminence that is given to anything other than Christ is anti-Christ. Even when an angel from heaven came and spoke to John, and John was overwhelmed by who he was, he fell at his feet in Revelation 19:10. And he worshiped the angel, and the angel picked him up and said, I am a servant like unto you, worship God. Anything that accepts devotion, anything that requires devotion from us, requires our undying allegiance over Christ, is anti-Christ. And here's the thing, Satan can get that into our lives in a deceptive way. Remember, we picture, Revelation is interesting how it pictures it. It gives you a picture that is so obvious that it's hard for us to think how these people think. I mean, there's a beast that comes out of the sea, and he's got 7 heads and 10 horns, and you're like, hey, I'm going to join his team. That's not really the picture we get. And that's on purpose. That's on purpose, because the book of Revelation wants us to see who he really is. But we read the chapter, everyone flocked to him. Who is like the beast? Who wouldn't worship him? And everybody did worship him. They deceived everybody. They were really under the impression they were doing the right thing, giving their allegiance. I mean, think about it. The world is falling apart. We just need to band together. I mean, we all had family, and you lost someone, and I lost someone, and we need questions answered. And here this guy saying that we can all just do it as a team. And you know what? Yeah, let's do it as a team. I'm gonna wave that flag. I'm gonna change my Facebook profile to I'm for the beast because I like that guy. He seems like he's really for unity, and I wanna be for unity too. And if you're not for him, why do you hate people? You know, what's your problem? And so what he does is he requires allegiance. Antichrist wants to replace God in your life. His goal is to have something else sit on the throne of your heart. It doesn't matter how powerful they are, but Christ is the only one that's supposed to sit on our heart, the throne of our heart. It doesn't matter how much you respect those people. Christ is the only one that's supposed to sit on our heart. It doesn't matter how much sentiment we have thinking about what it might be. Christ is the only one that's supposed to sit on our heart. If Jesus is not on the throne of our heart, then whatever we have replaced him with is anti-Christ. Now, in this particular instance, what was it that they worshiped instead? They worshiped a political leader. They worshiped their new nation that they had made. Where devotion to the group was more important than devotion to Christ. Where devotion to a person was more important than devotion to Christ. And not everything that we give that allegiance to is necessarily evil. But it becomes anti-Christ when it replaces Christ. And there's a lot of Christians who have allowed anti-Christ into their heart by replacing Jesus with political rulers and with groups. Where we're more known by our political affiliation for a person or for a party than we are for Jesus. That is anti-Jesus, because it's a replacer of Jesus. Antichrist is a replacer of Jesus. Antichrist is a redefiner of good. A redefiner of good. Look at verse number 6. This is so counterintuitive, but see how he does this. Verse 6. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in the earth. God is bad, his people are bad, his tabernacle is bad, and it was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And power was given unto him for all kindreds and tongues and nations. So he speaks blasphemies against God, and he destroys the saints because they are the enemies, and he is good. He has taken good and called it evil, and taken evil and called it good. He's a redefiner of good. That's why Isaiah 5 says, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. Woe unto them that are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight. Woe unto them that are mighty to drink wine and men of strength to mingle strong drink, which justify the wicked for reward and take away the righteousness of the righteous from him. We don't get to define what is good and evil. But maybe that's not where we are. Maybe we're not trying to take what's obviously evil and what's obviously good and swap them, which is what we see in our world, by the way. And our world does try to get us to bow down to it. Maybe we don't get to do that. Maybe we don't. Maybe that's not our particular issue. But Jesus, one of the people he was the most strong against in his ministry was Pharisees. Why? Not because they called good evil and evil good, but they felt that they got to define what good meant. Right? And they said, no, what we say is important, and not necessarily what the Bible says is important. He says to them, you blind guides, you strain in a gnat and swallow a camel. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You may clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but within are full of extortion and excess. You blind Pharisees, cleanse first that which is within the cup and platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you're like unto whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outward, but are within full of dead men's bones and of all uncleanness. Even so you also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you are full of hypocrisy and iniquity. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of prophets and garnish the sepulchres of the righteous. And say, if we had been in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partakers with them in the blood of the prophets. But wherefore ye be witnesses unto yourselves that ye are the children of them which killed the prophets. Fill ye up then the measure of your fathers. Ye serpents, ye generation of vipers, how can ye escape the damnation of hell? Hardly stronger words were given to the Antichrist himself. Not because they had taken good and evil and swapped it like Antichrist does and like our world system does, but they had said, I think I should define what is important and what is not, and then required it of everybody around them. Jesus' rebuke is those who are Antichrist, which were in this case religious people. It's not of God when we choose what is right and what is wrong and what is important and what is not. That is of the devil when we redefine what is important. Let us be careful to add to or take away from the message of God's word, which is what he admonishes us not to do at the end of the book of Revelation, by our own opinions and our beliefs about what is essential and what is not. Why? Because lastly, an antichrist is a destroyer of Christians. A destroyer of Christians. Look at verse number 7. It was given unto him to make war with the saints and to overcome them, and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. He had defined right and wrong, but the saints did not fit into that new definition he had made. And so, he was persecuting and killing them for the sake of the good. Is Antichrist to tear down the people of God. But what's sad is that some, not all, for sure, we know that this world is filled with Antichrist that tears down God's people and calls them enemies. And yet, I mean, you're sitting in church, so obviously that might not belong to you. But and yet, I see around America that sometimes the harshest critics of another Christian is another Christian. And when he tells us not to bite or devour one another, he says that of the church within itself. Jesus' last prayer was about you and me. He says, I pray not only for them, but them that will also hear their message. So that's us. And his primary prayer that we would be one. Some works of the flesh are variance and strife, which is to break apart unity. Proverbs chapter 6 says, one of the seven abominations in God's eyes is sowing discord among the brethren. And here's the problem. You and I take it upon ourselves to redefine what is good and evil and what is important and what is not, then we become destroyers of those around us. And that is not of Jesus. That is anti-Jesus. That is anti what God is trying to accomplish. That is in opposition to him. And that can deceptively seep into our lives. And we can welcome it with open arms for the common good and wave the flag. That is Antichrist. But, number two, how are we deceived? Shouldn't it be obvious? I mean, he came with a beast with seven heads and 10 horns, so it's obviously that he's not our friend. But he doesn't come as a beast, just like Satan doesn't come with a red suit and horns like John saw him in Revelation chapter 12. The Bible actually describes the false prophet as coming like a lamb. Didn't you see that in the passage? Verse number, it's here, 11. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, but he spake as a dragon. That's why it said in Matthew 24, there will come false Christs and false prophets, insomuch if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. They can easily be followed. Why a lamb? I can't answer the horns. I've heard some of the commentators try to define the horns. I have a real hard time with it, so I'm just going to not even try, okay? So, sorry. But I think the lamb is interesting. There's a couple things I could say to this. One is that Jesus is the lamb throughout the book of Revelation. So there's this false lamb, just like we have a false Christ. But another thing that's interesting is that this is coupled together with his deception. And it reminded me, of course, maybe it reminded you already, of a statement that Jesus made in Matthew chapter 7, where he says, beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing. But inwardly they are ravening wolves. Later on he says, wherefore by their fruits ye shall know him. Just because it glitters doesn't mean that it's gold. So J.A. Sice later says this, Satan, as anti-God, glorifies with his glory the final Antichrist, while men in their depravity and delusion rejoice in it and cry their loudest devotion to his hell-derived majesty. Imagine, he says, all that has ministered to the glory of worldly empires in the ages past, the imposing array of intellect, knowledge, arts, and arms, the splendor of oriental monarchs, the valor and grandeur of mighty heroes and conquerors, the eloquence, wisdom, and power of statesmen, orators, and poets, and all the varieties of mental accomplishment and external greatness united in one marvelous man, possessed of all the hitherto divided power and distributed attractions of all preceding times. And where is the soul, he says, untaught of God, that would not run with wild, enthusiastic adoration over him? Yet this is the sort of appeal which this beast makes to the unsanctified millions of his time. Not as an instrument of terror, dismay, and horror in his revelation, but with all the blandishing allurements of the sublimest champion of human interests and greatness. He's not going to come to you with an axe telling you he wants to kill you all. He's going to come as the savior of mankind and to give all the gifts he can possibly give you, and they will welcome him with open arms. They will be deceived. Why? Why are they deceived? Why are we deceived? Why do we allow Antichrist into our hearts and our minds? Because of power. Power. Power is a huge temptation. I mean, the idea that Satan would give all kingdoms of men if you just bow down and worship him. But power is not only a temptation for us, but it's also an influence. I mean, this man is the most powerful man in the world. The fact that he has all 10 crowns on his head, the fact that the beast is the embodiment of all kingdoms of men all at the same time, he has all of that power, but not just the power of influence, he also has the power of ability. Look back down to verse number 3. It says this, I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. So somehow along the way, he is wounded fatally, and yet either survived or appeared to come back from the dead. And so people are like, wow, he must be special. And this is what it says of the false prophet they pointed at. Verse number 13. He doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of all men. He's just like Elijah. He can do all these great things. Verse number 14. And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth. Why? By means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had a wound by a sword and did live. And what does he do to this image? He had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed. So it looks like he would have been dead, and yet he lived. The false prophet, he can do all of these miracles. He makes an image, and then the image talks. And that's actually very ironic, because the Bible always makes fun of images. Who has a mouth but cannot speak? Ah, but his can, so it must be legitimate. And so by the things he can do, by the power that he has, by the ability he portrays, he must be worthy to be followed. The Bible actually specifically warns against thinking this way. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, it gives you the sign of a false prophet. And he says, if he comes to you, and he does wonders, but he says, hey, let's go and worship other gods. He says, do not follow him. Because the test of whether somebody is legitimate is not what they can or cannot do. It's whether they speak truth or not. But we are deceived because of power people have, influence people have, ability people have. Matthew 24, I've read it 3 times already, but it talks about these false Christs and false prophets. They will show great signs and wonders and deceive, if it were possible, the very elect. Why? Because of the stuff they can do, the power that they have. 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 says the same thing, that when they will come with power and signs and lying wonders. This would certainly be true for us in a literal sense. If somebody would do a miracle, we would take them a little bit more seriously. But why is it that people flock to those who are peddling lies? Sometimes it's because of their abilities. They're impressive. They're smart. Therefore, they are right. Power. I mean, we see this in our young people. They idolize the opinions of people who are sports players. They must be right because they can handle a ball well. How do those two things connect? They don't. And yet, adults who have more wisdom about them will be deceived by the same thing. If somebody stands up and they seem impressive, they must be right. Power does not equal truth. Neither does popularity. Because see, at this time, it's not just that he has a lot of power and a lot of influence and a lot of ability, but he's also liked by everyone around him. Look what he says in verse number 11. I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. So the speaking as a dragon is not only that he's speaking evil things, but the book of Daniel actually describes this last little horn, this last kingdom, as speaking with great swelling words. He will have the ability to make people want to listen to him. But that doesn't make it true. I read a lot of different books. Some of the books that I read are actually about public speaking because I do a little bit of that. And so I want to make it better. And some of them are completely secular. Like, how do you make what you're saying easier to listen to and easier to understand? But the one thing that I have to remind myself is my message is not more or less powerful just because of the way in which it's communicated. The power comes from the truth. But in 2 Peter chapter 2, it says this, they will speak great swelling words of vanity. They said it really good and they said a whole lot of nothing. I have heard speeches like that. They were really easy to listen to, but they said nothing. There was nothing communicated, they must be right about whatever it was that they said. I don't know what it was, but I agree. And this is what the world does. They, by the popularity they bring to them, it's like, well, they must be right because they sounded good. But earlier it says this, verse number 3 and 4. Because of the abilities he had, because of the way that he spoke, look at what happened. He had the deadly wound, he was healed. Verse number four. They worshiped the dragon, which had given power unto the beast. They worshiped the beast, saying, watch, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Everyone's like, wow, he's so great. Nobody can defeat him. Nobody can conquer him. Nobody's like him. Everybody around him was flocking to him. And so everyone else did too. It's easier to follow something that looks good, that sounds good, and everybody else is following too. This is why sometimes social media can be dangerous, although it's not the mark of the beast, regardless of whether or not a monster can says WWW on it. But this is why social media can be dangerous, because it can make Antichrist look good, sound good, and give us the pressure of following along with everyone else that is thinking it too. And we get the popular opinion pushed into our minds and our hearts every single day. I'm not saying social media is bad, but what I'm saying is it's easy to go with what is popular. And that popularity might be the world as a whole. And it might be whatever your group says. And that takes me to my last one. Why are we deceived? Power, popularity, and pressure. Pressure. I actually put all three of those P's by accident. It just worked out that way. So I'm not an alliterator, but there it was. Pressure. Look at verse number 16. So after all this, what if somebody says, you know what? No, I don't wanna go along with that. Maybe they can see through it. They can count the number of his name. They can distinguish the mark for what it truly is. But that's not good enough. He says this, verse 16, he calls us all both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond. It doesn't really matter who you are, what your position was or isn't. To receive a mark in their right hand or in their forehead, so that no man might buy or sell, save he that had that mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Maybe you aren't deceived by Antichrist in this world, but you live around Antichrist. You work near Antichrist. You live in a world where Antichrist is. And there's the pressure that if you don't follow along, it will be to your detriment. Maybe you're worried. Maybe you're worried that you will lose your job if you do not bow down to Antichrist. Maybe you're worried about what your family will think of you if you do not bow down to Antichrist. Maybe you're worried about whether the group that you associate with will reject you because you do not bow down to their redefinition of good and their destroyer of Christians. The Bible says in Proverbs that the fear of man bringeth a snare. But whoso putteth his trust in the Lord shall be safe. We will do and believe and follow a lot of things just to not feel too much pressure. I can't imagine how many people walked down to the DMV where they had to get the mark of the beast officially signed by the notary, just because everyone else in their neighborhood said that you had to. Somebody from the HOA came by and knocked on your door and asked whether or not you did or not, or else they're going to give you a fine or whatever it might be. Thanksgiving was very awkward because everyone in their family got the mark. Why didn't you? Why do you hate your country? Why do you hate your family? And maybe we're not deceived, but we will give into it anyway simply because of the pressure. So then what? This chapter is one of those chapters in the middle of the book that can cause us to feel small and destined to lose. But remember, the book of Revelation is about Jesus winning. And also doesn't allow us to be deceived when it portrays it. That's why when it shows us Satan and the beast and tells us everybody's deceived by him, it shows us as a dragon and something that has 7 heads and 10 horns. We see what's really happening. And in the middle of all this, he also wants us to know these people will lose. And he wants us to live and make our decisions in light of that. So I'm going to read the only two verses that we didn't read, which are couched right in the middle of this chapter. Look at verse number 9. Because this is what caught my attention as I first opened this chapter a couple weeks ago and had zero idea what I was going to do with this chapter. I noticed that he actually gives an admonition to the reader, which I was surprised. I just thought this was about the Antichrist. We could talk about end times and tribulation period and go on. But not only does 1 John 2 tell us to apply this to our life, but this chapter reminds us of one very important truth. Verse 9, if any man have an ear, let him hear. That's interesting. Remember that? That showed up a lot of times in Revelation 2 and 3. Jesus gives a message to each church and then finishes and says, he that hath ears to hear, let him hear. Listen to what I'm saying to you. Well, what are we supposed to listen here? What is he trying to tell us in this chapter of all chapters? This is what he says, verse 10. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints. What he's saying simply is this. Those that destroy will be destroyed. Those that lead into captivity will go into captivity. Those that kill with the sword will be killed by the sword. It's exactly what he said. I actually, for those of you in my Sunday school class, I said in Jeremiah chapter 15, where they said, what's going to happen to us? It says, if you're for death, then you'll go to death. If you're for the sword, to the sword. For famine, you'll go to the famine. You're for captivity, you'll go to captivity. You reap what you sow. And so he's saying this, do not be deceived by the power, by the popularity, and by the pressure of Antichrist in your world. Everything that is opposed to Jesus, whether in obvious form or in cloaked form, what we are deceived by, is not your friend. And everything that is opposed to Jesus doesn't win. Everything that hurts people will be hurt. Everything that destroys people will be destroyed. And he says, and that would be true for you. And so he comes to you and he says, do not take the bait that Satan gives you, that I will give you the world if you just bow down to me. He says, because he does not win. And he's not the one with the book in his hand that has the world to give you. Because Jesus is the one who has that. It's just pending right now. Satan can't give you the world. He promises you the world, but he can't give you the world. And maybe at times, Antichrist seems to have the world. But when the story ends, Jesus wins. And all those who destroy will be destroyed. And so he says this, here is the patience and faith of the saints. How can I endure all of this? It gets rough at times. Remember that you are living in the layover between when Jesus already defeated Satan and when he just comes back and solidifies it. You just have to have patience and faith to trust that it's always better to follow Christ and not anti-Christ.